Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Christopher Casey Carter, the CEO and founder of Epic Leadership, a coaching and training organization, and the author of Permission to Glow, a spiritual guide to epic leadership. In addition to his coaching and leadership work, Casey is also a professional songwriter, TEDx speaker, and international retreat leader. He is currently working on his second book and preparing to lead the upcoming Winter Glow Yoga Retreat at Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health. In this conversation, Casey chronicles his early success in music, his purpose in integrating spirit with leadership work, and his ability to honor his inner child alongside his professional commitments. Side by Side is now available on all major listening platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Amazon Music. Give us a like and leave us a review if you find value in our conversations. All our content is available at sidebysidepodcast.podbean.com. And if you're interested in connecting with me, please visit www.robertkwonhome.com. Do you remember the first time we met? I'm trying to think back because it may be because of Camp GLP, because I was there for one of the years.
I have a very vivid moment, a memory of the moment probably that you came into my consciousness. You were in line for a meal at Camp GLP, probably lunch. It was like middle of the day. And the first thing I noticed was like, this dude has like major style. You know, like it wasn't just like typical camping gear. There was like a whole vibe, you know what I mean? Like, and that was my first thought, and, you know, didn't really get to know you well until we started working together many months later, maybe even a year or so or more later. Yeah. I remember that day pretty clearly. That's one of the good byproducts of meditation. It gives you a pretty vivid memory.
And that's saying a lot because that experience, you were quite preoccupied to say the least, because you were sort of like the Energizer Bunny
everywhere.
Of Camp GLP. And so we didn't really have a moment to connect, but I do credit Jonathan and Stephanie Fields for making that a possibility. And then it may even have been like maybe a couple years later that I was in one of the community groups for the Camp GLP. And I said, I think I'm looking for some support one-on-one. And I've never really explored coaching before, but I kind of would like to break some like patterns overall. And I had this distinct memory of Jonathan commenting again, you know, who you reach out to is Christopher. And so he once again kind of guided me. This person who I've never really spoken to, but greatly admired from a distance, was once again made the connection happen. And I did reach out to you. And that was a very pivotal point in my life because I was working in nonprofit in a cubicle and trying to develop personally, let's say, in between lunch breaks. And those are some of the heydays, so to speak. Anyway, that's my memory.
Well, I mean, I think most of us, if we're lucky, get that journey from being stuck in something like a cubicle, typically is what it manifests as, into like more purpose-driven work, more knowing what we're here to do, more surrendering into the beautiful mess of all of that, because you have to answer the big questions like, how will I make money? What is my value? You know, how do I get paid to be me? You know, as hard as that journey is for you or for me, I mean, we're all, I think, on it if we choose to be. And the ones who answer that call and do that work of figuring it out, I believe ultimately lead more fulfilling lives and ultimately, you know, create more impact than had they just stayed to the very safe path of the jobby job. And you know, honestly, that's on my mind almost every day, Robert. You know, I'm bringing a family of five along in tow for my journey. And, you know, the financial pressures, the, you know, kids in college, all of those things, they just never end. They just keep getting more intense. And as they do, I'm always wondering, like, am I just dragging my family along on some wild fever dream, pipe dream thing? Or am I teaching them how to be themselves and to surrender into purpose? And on my best days as a coach and as a dad, I believe it's the latter, that I'm, you know, an example of somebody who's just willing to surrender into purpose.
Well, I've seen some of your work shepherding detention as a fellow musician. And, you know, yeah. I didn't know this at the time, many years ago now, but I didn't know you had this rich musical background, somewhat similar to mine, although different genres, mm-hmm. different cultures right. or whatever. But I actually didn't have a chance to ask you about some of those things growing up. And I'm curious about some of your like earlier favorite memories that involved like music.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Thanks for asking this. I mean, music, I get chills just even thinking about music. Music is one of those things that is never quite done with me. You know, I've wanted to set it down at different points because, you know, time to make the money or time to go after the big whatever contract that the next gig won't provide musically or whatever. And it's just something that's, you know, took root at a very young age and stayed with, it was kind of like the first language I could speak with any level of confidence. I think we've talked about this, you know, something I've always really respected about you. A lot of your breakthroughs came around just being willing to practice, you know, to find the pattern, to create the muscle memory, the joy of development and getting better in mastery. I mean, that to me is everything on the coaching path. And that to me all came from music. You know, I grew up as a fan of the band Rush, which was very like a prog rock complex music. It was never fun to cover because most bands just couldn't. It was really brutal to learn. It's more orchestrated. And I would just sit down and learn it note for note, any instrument, you know, and it stayed with me. And my daughter, who you mentioned, is in a band Detention. They're a pop punk band out of Ohio. And as they start to tour and play bigger festivals, they played a festival here. They headlined, they started playing it when they were 9 and 10 years old years ago. And now they're all between 16 to 20. And they headlined it and about 4,000 people showed up, bought many thousands of dollars worth of t-shirts. It was just a very surreal moment of arrival where I realized like, not only are they this is their graduation day locally, mm-hmm. like into the national spotlight, mm-hmm. but it felt like my graduation as a manager. Like I've done everything I can as a dad manager. And now it's time to hand it on to a more capable shepherd than what I've been able to do. But I love talking music. I got teary the other day on the way back from a show with my daughter because we're very rarely alone, the two of us, without the rest of the family or out the rest of the band around. And we just talked about art the whole way home, like on a 3-hour drive, and what it means to create and how good it feels to have a new song to share. You know, she will always be my only kid who really gets that. And it's been, I really got emotional because I never had anybody like that in my life to talk to about the creation process as a kid. You know, my parents were like, what's this music thing? You know, what do we do? Really? What do we do with you? Oh, totally. Totally. It's like, what do we do with you? You know, you need to have a backup plan. And like, even my mom, who is incredibly supportive, her mantra was bass players are a dime a dozen. You better have a degree, which in some ways I'm grateful for because my degrees led to coaching, which is my ultimate path. But also that seed of doubt in the child's ability. And I made a decision with our kids. There are no backup plans in our house. There is only your dream.
Yeah.
Your dream is the plan. So get to work, work your ass off, write 1,000 songs, play 10 million shows, and hopefully you'll be happy with the result. Yeah. So music is the core of all that. You know, it's kind of how I do my business. It's how I design my brand, how I coach. I look at all of it as art and music.
Being a musician, having been being a performer currently, because you still play music. I've seen the clips,
yeah.
Some of those clips.
Right.
And you're also a meditator. You have a deep and committed practice. I'm curious, what have you learned about what captures people's attention?
That's another amazing question. I mean, attention is our most precious commodity. It is, you know, it determines the quality of our lives, the quality of our impact, our work, what we create. Attention is everything. And meditation trains that And all of these goddamn apps and algorithms and technologies, they train the opposite of that. Fragmentation, skewed focus, imposter syndrome, all of the, compare and despair. I mean, I could go on. So I think we got to be more vigilant than ever before with training that attention. And what I find grabs people's attention is just getting, some sort of pattern interrupt. That's what I was doing at camp when we met, I was essentially a clown dressed as a unicorn with like a guitar on, doing all the things. This very Enneagram 7 extra energy, right? But all of that is a pattern interrupt to get people to pay attention, because and it pushes a lot of people away who are introverts, but also they can't look away because it's like, what the hell is going on over there? What is that guy on, and where can I get some? Maybe, but more it's like, I leave no stone unturned when it comes to getting people's attention. And as a coach and as a dad, I think I have to do a lot of pattern interrupts to get people to that point where they can't look away and they have to face something about themselves. And to me, the most effective tools that do that are just simple redirections for people.
Yeah.
Hey, look at those shoes. Tell me about those shoes. And all of a sudden they have to, it takes them out of their fog or out of their whatever, their minds, and into their present moment. So meditation to me trains all of that stuff, So I do use music at the top of a lot of my videos, because people aren't expecting me to chant a Sanskrit mantra with a harmonium, for example. They don't see that coming. But there's something about Sanskrit that gets in people's bones, into their souls, that's so resonant where they just have to pay attention, even if they don't know what the words mean, and they typically don't. Sometimes I don't know the direct translation, but I know that if I'm administering that medicine, it will grab the right kind of attention. It might not be the millions of views or whatever the hell people are looking for, that metric, but it always grabs the right people, and the right people who pay attention stick around and work with me.
Yeah, I sometimes get in my head a little bit, in the house, and my partner would often do something silly or just kind of like funny to kind of get my attention a little bit, because they can see when I'm really in my head and kind of just like in my own bubble, so to speak. And sometimes that would kind of like frazzle me a little bit, but I've come to really appreciate the fact that someone wants to connect with me and therefore needs my attention. Like, that's what it really means,
Well, it's the great, we just got a second puppy. It's why people still get puppies. Puppies are great for that. They remind us that there's something more fun than all of our current sufferings, So when we come home with a lot on our mind, they just want to be greeted. They just want to be loved. Children are more like that than adults. And all of it reminds me to hold on to some of that.
So speaking of meditation, when did you first get into meditation, and what has that journey been for you? Because I know you also have gone through the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. So I'm curious if you can speak on just overall your meditation and spiritual journey a little bit.
Yeah. So how I really sum it up, Robert, is that I was a personal development junkie. Napster downloading Tony Robbins shit, and like Brian Tracy's goal exercises, and just being all of those things we can do, grasping at straws to grow, to become worthy of the pay check we want or the clients we want, whatever that is. And I think I'll always be that personal growth junkie. But where that path ended, I kept seeing over and over is contemplative practice, meditative practice, silencing the mind, creating space between your thoughts. And, it took me a lot of years to finally get on that path. I would lay in my basement. And when we lived in Chicago, I would lay in my basement in the dark in Shavasana, which is the end of yoga class, because I thought that was meditation. And I would just fall asleep, because that's what you do when you lay down in the dark. Did that for a year and started having some transcendent experiences, practiced on the train every day on my commute in Chicago. And that's when I got good at meditation, because I had to tune out all the insanity of being on the train. First generation iPod earbuds getting ripped out by people exiting the train, and I would still meditate. And so bringing that attention back 1,000,000,000 times every time it runs away was the muscle I needed to build. And eventually that led me to Yogananda's work, as you mentioned, read Autobiography of a Yogi, haven't stopped reading it. Tonight, I'm going to visit some monastic monks up in Cleveland who are on tour from Self-Realization Fellowship. They've become such a huge part of my spiritual journey. And, you know, as I got better at meditating, never mastering it. I'm not a guru. I'm not a, you know, like all we can do is teach people the processes. It's up to them to practice. You know what I mean? And, but as I've stuck with it, all sorts of wild paths in my life and in my work unfold. I never would have thought I'd be able to live the lifestyle we do being a spiritual coach. It just felt ridiculous. Or being, I was asked to join the board of directors for Yoga Alliance last year. So I sit on a global board with swamis and preeminent yoga teachers about bringing more yoga into the world. I never could have charted that out. That wasn't like a degree that was offered in college, you know, but meditation, I think just, it opens up that curiosity to watch, to allow the next thing to unfold and the next thing and the next thing. And so much of it is, you know, that basic, you know, practice of surrender, surrendering the thoughts, surrendering the emotions. I am the sky watching all weather move through me over and over and over to the point that your life transforms, your work transforms.
Well, and I've seen that with, in some ways, I saw that your meditation practice was also what made it possible for you to be the Energizer Bunny at a camp or facilitation.
Yeah.
It's like kind of having a little bit of balance in some ways. And you've kind of touched on this already, but how do you see the connection between your journey with yoga and meditation, and how does it relate to like coaching, facilitation, doing group work and one-on-one work?
Yeah. So for me, I'm an Enneagram 7, which means I'm a multifaceted, multi-talented energizer bunny of, I'm like a balloon animal maker, you know? And the 7 integrates to 5, which is very structured and pragmatic and to me, very devotional and focused. And so all of the good things, I needed to release things like addiction and gluttony. That work continues. I'm always addicted to something. I quit alcohol going on 12 years ago now, which was a really long time coming and really formative for me. I needed to prove to myself that I could do that. And as I did that, it made room for more yoga and meditation and all the good things in my life. So I look at it as the meditation practice gave me the muscles of willpower, of discernment. Does this serve me? Does this not? You know, very basic shit to just go make healthier choices. And as I've done that, I think I've been able to become somewhat of a mentor or an example. Like literally, if I could figure this out, anybody can. That's always my example. And that led to coaching leaders. Just yesterday, I had a great exploratory with this young man who's a venture capital. He's a principal of a venture capital fund out in California, and he's extraordinarily wealthy, in charge of tons of money and all this stuff. And he's a very powerful guy, happens to be Hindu, and his meditation practice has fallen off. So I thought, this is probably why we're really meeting, is so I could reinvigorate that, because I know when I do that, he'll be so much better off for all the other things in his life. And so that's how it played out for me. It doesn't always play out that way for everyone, but my clients who do find that meditation practice, ultimately that greases the gears of all this other change in their life that needs to take place. So it just makes the coaching process more fun. I'm able to gamify the change, because most people say they want to change, but when it shows up, you know this firsthand, man. When the change shows up, it's brutal. And it's like, no, I don't want that. It shows up as trauma. It shows up as growth we're unwilling to do. It shows up as grief and despair. The meditation practice, I think, softens all the edges of that and allows the transformation to take place.
Yeah, I think for me, music has that very much similar frequency for
totally.
Me. It's something that I can go back to. But as I've spoken with you, when we worked together, you know, I was away from it for like over a decade because of all of that unprocessed stuff, and I couldn't be at the keyboard. So doing some of the personal development and having these breakthroughs, as difficult and dismantling as it can be, that's the way it feels. It just feels like you're dismantling like all the things that you sort of knew and were familiar with about yourself. But on the other side of it, you can get something back that is sort of forever yours, which is like something like creative expression or just having the ability to have the space for yourself, you know? It's not something that, yeah.
Totally. Oh, well, and as you do that, you heal others. I mean, it is like your ultimate gift is, it's a gift to yourself, gift to others, gift to spirit, gift to the world. And it's counterintuitive in a capitalistic society because we kind of grow up wondering like, but will it pay the bills? Will it blah, blah, blah? I look at your music, Robert, as your yoga. It's like your union with something divine. You channel something, you tune in with something vast, and people get all kinds of emotional because you're just doing what you know how to do. It's beyond you. And that to me feels like yoga.
Yeah. I'm still setting a sturdier foundation with my meditation. And I think meditation is teaching me something about music, which is like, there are genuine moments where I don't have to try. I can just be, but those moments are so few and rare in between still for me that I'm still trying to expand that possibility to all the areas of my life. And one of the ways is to doing things like meditation, doing groups, a couple things, actually a bunch of things that I've done that you had shepherded and things like that. Just reminder for that structure and also community. Because with all of that you were sharing, there's also a great community that you can be embraced by, which is really wonderful.
Well, in all true spiritual traditions, the reason why people still go to church, I believe, it isn't just to get shamed and guilted by the person or the hypocrite at the pulpit. It's to experience the satsang, the fellowship, the community, and shoulder to shoulder with our family and our peers, and to know that we're on a journey together. That's very much a part of our spiritual tradition. That's why I'm driving 50 miles tonight to go hang with devotees and meditate with monks, is because they don't come around here often enough, you know? But that, just to go back to something I think is really important for you and for everyone, is to make the distinction between meditation practice on our own, like eyes closed meditation practice on our own, with some of these other meditative practices like music, like running, like hatha yoga, doing our stretches and stuff. I think it's so key to get to that point of 15 minutes a day minimum every day just sitting. Because what we're doing is we're bringing our meta attention back over and over and building that. So it wanders away and we bring it back to the breath, back to a mantra, back to our body, whatever that may be. And as we do that, you know, you may have noticed this. I play music differently after I meditate. I run differently through the forest. I ride my motorcycle differently. I engage with my family differently after I meditate. It's because I spent some time in that mental and emotional gymnasium, bringing my attention back. That is what I think is really so key in modern life, is to make that little bit of time investment to know that it's going to enrich all these other practices that follow. Because it's easy for us to say like, oh, running's my meditation, music's my meditation. And in many ways it is, it's meditative. But our meditation, as I understand it, as Yogananda taught it, is that really dedicated time to, you know, he would say time devoted to connecting with God. But in modern vernacular, I find it's most inclusive to say it's our time to strengthen our meta attention so we can connect with whatever we choose to connect with. Might be God, might be music, might be others.
Yeah, I think I've noticed in trying to explore that, you know, after doing a meditation or just, I don't even know if it's that complex. Sometimes I'm sitting here allowing myself to just be in stillness and be with my breath before I start recording. Mm-hmm. And other times it's sort of allowing all the permission to feel all the feels and then hit record. There are some magical moments like that. But both of those require you to be connected, which is the tough part. So how can you stay connected
with
going on with you?
Yeah. Well, and I think we have to look at like what is actually tough about that. Because usually we have to face something about ourselves. Like we have to be the guy who owns the podcast or be the leader who walks into the room feeling unprepared or be dot, 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 which is typically scary. So we dissociate, we go doom scroll, we eat our feelings, we do anything but claim our power. And that's really the exploration of my book, Permission to Glow, is to just incite people to claim their power in these little micro moments throughout the day. And to me, that like so much of that starts and ends with meditation. Because trust me, I want to become somebody that I love eventually, you know, and I some days I do. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think we all want to become a person whose company we enjoy. And it's hard for to find those 5 minutes, let alone 15 minutes, let alone an 8-hour Christmas meditation, which is what we do in my tradition on Christmas Day, an 8-hour Christmas meditation.
Eight hours?
Yeah.
With the family?
No. Oh, okay. No. With my spiritual family, sure. You know, with devotees who have worked on that practice for years. But what that breaks down to is 50 minutes of meditation and 10 minutes of chanting for 8 hours. And so it just keeps taking you deeper and deeper past yourself. You don't care about yourself, you know, an hour or two in. You care about, you feel the presence of whatever that is. And that in that season, it's the Christ consciousness. Those ways we resist sitting in silence with ourselves, like, I get it. It's scary up here. It's most mornings I wake up like everybody else, very terrified of my own thoughts. Dark and stormy. And I wish I could say it gets better in your 40s, Robert. It might, but it might not. You know, I think we just have to become more vigilant to do the work of realizing, like, oh, these are those thoughts and these are the aches in my body. And I'll do a little yoga and I'll do a little mental yoga to bring myself into alignment. You end up, I believe, better than where you started.
Absolutely. And really quickly, this is a tangent I forgot to bring back. That, like, variations of mindfulness, let's say, because they're not all meditation, although they're meditative, is also taught in, like, musicians to help with, like, injury prevention. Meaning, like, when we disconnect from our body and what's going on with us, there can be some serious consequences. So even something like that, I'm mindful of, can I get on the piano and be with my body and the music rather than feeling like I have to sacrifice and neglect everything in order to pursue this one moment or something like that. But I wanted to bring that up because, you know, stage fright is a big one, but honestly, another one is like just injuries, things of life that can really affect an artist.
And those injuries come in many, many forms, right? Rejection, attachment to whatever, and having to live with not getting the thing we want. I realized last week as I was trying to exit New York City and all the flights were canceled, find out when I get to get to the airport, you know, and I had to make the decision, rent a car and drive home 7 hours so it wouldn't disrupt my whole weekend with my family. And I feel like we're entering, if we haven't already, the age of massive disruption. To stay more committed to our art or our expression in the face of all sorts of wild upheavals and reversals and stuff. I mean, it takes a lot of awareness and a lot of presence and dedication to entertain that. You know, it becomes ridiculous, you know. Do I write my newsletter today when the whole world is crumbling down? Goddamn right, you better. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if not you, then who? If not now, then when? You know, so it's, but I love what you said about being an artist. Is to me, it's such a defiant act in a world that tries to train us away from that, that when we give ourselves that permission, everyone around us benefits, starting with us.
Yeah. In fact, you have this line inside Permission to Glow, your book, that talks about silencing the inner dialogue has launched many epic spiritual quests.
Right.
We've talked about just a few versions of that, from like the deep-rooted creative expression to just wholeness. I am curious, what inner dialogue did you feel like you had to silence in order to like get here now?
Yeah. Well, it still travels with me, you know?
Yeah.
It is, I think I describe it in the book as like, it's an incessant, it's like a DVD commentary mixed with the show Drunk History on the Comedy Channel. It's like Drunk History DVD commentary incessant. And that's very much an Enneagram 7 thing. That's like my one stress. Under stress, I go to 1, which is a very judgmental one. From what I understand, Enneagram 1s have the worst self-talk, which we should give them a lot of compassion for, because 1s are very important to all of us. But that shows up for me as just the constant second guessing, judging, ever present. Really? Are you going? So I started launching these. I'm teaching at Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health. Mm-hmm. It's been a dream to even be a guest there, but let alone to be invited to teach there about my book. I mean, it's just very, the suburb I grew up in Ohio didn't prepare you for that path, you know? So my voice is always like, who are you from the white trash suburb of Ohio to go be this guy at Kripalu and wear a yoga scarf and do whatever? Like there's always that thing, you know? And the best I can do is to love that thing that's trying to protect me. Love the little boy who never gave up and stuck with it. I keep my inner child picture next to me looking at in my face at my desk, because those are the kids that never gave up. And if I've made it this far, I can't stop now. You know, like I'm unquestionably on a spiritual quest. You know, I look around my office and my client base and the venues I get to teach in. It is having these kinds, this quality of conversation with people I respect. This is to me what I always wanted. And will that carnival barker inside of me speak up today and want to speak its piece? Oh, totally. But am I willing to tell it to STFU and, you know, stand down? Totally. Like that's the work.
Carnival barker. That's a new one for me. That's a really funny nickname. Carnival barker.
Oh gosh. I have a friend who we do this thing where we're always, this is one of the things I hated about living in Los Angeles. I loved it in some ways, but Los Angeles has a reputation for having a lot of flake culture. People that'll commit to having plans and then just bail.
Yeah.
And they'll use traffic as an excuse, or always traffic typically. So when you move out from Ohio and you're very earnest and you want to make plans and people keep flaking on you, you take it personally. But so I call that or best offer culture, OBO. And a lot of us are like that in our careers, like executive clients I coach all the time. They want to parlay what they've built already into 18 months at this job and then double my pay with more stock options and then double my pay. But they're chasing something there. They're chasing really legacy and impact and meaning, but they can't get that by job hopping. But they stay stuck in that, you know, grind of or best offer. So it feels like winning, but then the honeymoon wears off even quicker and then you're back into the thing. So that's when I say the carnival barker shows up, or the old timey auctioneer, like, you know, that's their inner dialogue at all times. But are they willing to silence that and just remember, go back to look at what was I ultimately creating here? What is the most important thing? And 9 times out of 10, most leaders want to create something better where they are versus keeping running from it.
Right.
You know, so I really, for the most part, I try to coach people into sticking around and building the bridge from where they are. I mean, you and I worked on that. And then, you know, when it's time, when it's overstayed its welcome, or you know when it's time to go. But like doing it prematurely just because of or best offer tends to lead to more of the cycle of suffering.
It's always a good, I mean, if you want coaching, it's a great place to look at relationship patterns. I'll tell you that much. And that alone will give you a lot of insight.
Yeah.
I have a couple like more, to me, like more fun questions that's a little more just personal and things like that. I listened to a little bit of the Christopher Carter Show. I did not know it was on Spotify.
Oh, wow. Oh, amazing. You know what's so funny about this? My daughter drove to her show with another band family, the drummer and his mom, who good friends. And my daughter made everyone listen to that record on the drive down. So when we got to set up for the detention show, everybody wanted to talk about this record I haven't thought about in years, and still very proud of it, you know, but it's like, yeah. So it's crazy you're bringing this up. Okay. What are your questions about the Christopher Carter Show?
Oh, let's say, like, do you have a favorite track or like a memorable connection to a track on, you know, either of the two albums?
Or Making It. Yeah. Like, well, first question I have is like, because coaches ask coaches questions, right? What stuck out for you about that body of work? Did you see or hear the continuity in who you got to know as a coach, as a person, with that music in any way?
Yeah. Well, I immediately thought, I see where your daughter got her essence from, a part of her essence. She's her own person.
Yeah.
But I saw a connection, a continuity in the sounds. And I guess I may be projecting a little bit, because I didn't find out until the pandemic was already happening that my grandfather on my father's side was also a composer. I just had no idea, because I had no connection. So and I recently found out there's no record of what his composition sounds like. So I have to make it up. But somewhere deep down, yeah, I really wanted to know what was his quote unquote sound. What did that sound like? And I'm always thinking about, like, can I try to capture that even though I'm playing with something that I didn't really know him. So I felt like I saw the connection between you and your daughter. And then, you know, punk, I'm getting a little nerdy, but punk mm-hmm. is a pretty powerful movement, not just a musical yeah. movement.
And right. so it's an energy.
What it represents in the world has been around for a while. And is it the thing I would listen to every morning? Maybe not, but like, I really respect kind of the movement and the power of punk. So like, to me, it's not just the music, but it's also like a literal, like, people's movement at times. Right. So anyway, the yeah. kind of sound that's on there felt very like reflective of that kind of looking back at society and mm. looking back at growing up.
Yeah, there's a lot of nostalgia on that record. I was in my 30s, and that's what really sticks with me, like early 30s, reconciling who I was becoming from where I grew up, you know. So songs like Favorite Idiot, all about my doomed, very young attempts at relationships. The When No One's Home, singing by yourself into the hairbrush, playing air guitar. I did that every day. Like, I was a performer when there was no crowds, you know. And then I ended up joining a band and going on tour and playing for thousands of people every night. Like, that's what I did for a couple years straight, 250 shows a year. Joined my favorite band in college as a bass player. Many years later, when I was writing those songs, I was like reconciling all this past stuff. And I love it that you tied it to my daughter's work, because she did have the fortune of growing up with a parent who played music openly and loved music and shared music. And there's a lot of my favorite photos are of her just absorbing and looking up at me singing, you know. And I knew she was going to become a beast. So watching her far exceed my music career now, it truly is the biggest reward. And even more so because she's a young female in a very male-dominated space. She just goes out there like a fearless beast and just bends the whole room to her will. And that's more of her mom than it is me. You know, I may have given her some musical ideas and chops or tips on writing, but they ended up covering a song that's on that record, a song called Not To Go. And that song not only found a life on radio recently through Detention, it's on Sirius XM. They've been making pretty great money through music publishing, through songs getting on radio. That song, their version of it, got picked up for a movie that's weirdly about Ohio called Escaping Ohio. So seeing songs that I wrote years ago that now have life through my daughter's love of playing them is kind of the surprise. That's what I was saying. Like, music grabs me by the ear and says, I am not done with you, you know? I believe that the things that we love that love us, like yoga, meditation, songwriting, composition, they have plans for us. You know, the intuitive hit I got when you brought up your grandfather was like, dude, I am talking to his composition right now.
Yeah, there are times where genuinely my intention, when I have one for improv, it would be like, oh, let's try to come up with something that grandmother would like or grandfather would like. And yeah. And just to stay with it and just to see what happens. It's interesting. Doing something like music makes me think about my lineage a lot more. And I see some of that with you and your daughter and through music.
Well, it's funny. It too, like, you brought up punk rock. I mean, I listened to the album American Idiot. That album changed my life. Green Day album American Idiot. It was like a punk rock opera. Still to this day, it holds up as a phenomenal piece of work. Yeah. And I listened to it driving across the country from LA. We had Elliot, our first daughter. She was born in LA. As a baby, she flew with her mom to Chicago. We were moving there. I drove with the dog across the country to meet the family. Probably listened to that record 25 times, just on a loop, you know, during election season. We still lost the election. John Kerry lost to George Bush. All of that angst and don't want to be an American idiot, that anti-establishment thing, became such a part of my identity. And even before that, Ani DiFranco, incredible feminist songwriter, she wrote the cover quote from my book, which meant the world to me. She's a feminist icon and really like a punk rock folk artist. And that ethos, I think, is very much in my songwriting. And it's also in how I coach and how I brand as a coach, because there's so much bullshit out there in the coaching industry, like a lot of snake oil, faker, pseudo coaches. rather than be out railing against that, I want to differentiate through my counterintuitive approach to living, counterintuitive approach to living or to coaching, raising a family. It's a very punk rock ethos.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't grow up around punk, but I think a part of me resonates with that whenever I see something like Injustice or something like that. And anyway.
Well, there's no shortage of things to be just genuinely upset about in the world. You know, it's like, yeah. And punk is one choice. Like, honestly, being a classical, I mean, you are so many counters to the norm, Robert. I couldn't even list them all out. That in itself is punk rock. It might not be the choice of music in Spotify the first time you open it up, but that's what makes you identify with it. It's like, it's that we can do better. We must do better. And to me, that really comes through in great punk rock and great composition in general.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for your time today. And I really want you to tell listeners what are some things that's going on that people can connect with you over, or if they just wanted to connect with you maybe one-on-one, what are some, what's the best way to do that? Yeah.
Definitely. Well, thanks for that. And it's been a pleasure. I'm really grateful to have this conversation with you, Robert. You're always one of my favorite people to talk to.
Same.
And the best place to find me is epicleadership.org. We've rebranded this epic life as Epic Leadership. It's all built around the four permissions in my book, Permission to Glow. I love people to check out the book. I'm still very, very proud of it. I will finish our audiobook someday, hopefully sooner than later, Robert. Robert composed phenomenal stuff, and the enormity of that project and what it means to me. That season two album, by the way, took me 8 years to finish. Or no, 5 years. 5 years to finish.
Because you did all the parts, did you not?
I played all the instruments except the drums.
Yeah. I knew it. There are musicians who do that, and I
It's madness. It's a level of madness, and ultimately it wasn't about the selling of the units afterwards. It was about who I became as an artist.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. And which is crazy making. But I will finish that audiobook, and I'd love for people to check out the upcoming winter retreat at Kripalu Center. We're doing Winter Glow, which is yoga and meditation around the four permissions, which I'm just excited to get cozy at that. That place is like Hogwarts for yoga. I never want to leave every time I go. So think about it.
I might have to check that out. And I'll be sure to post a link if there is one for...
Yeah, for sure.
That. Yeah. Yep. Thank you for giving me part of your morning time, Christopher, Casey.
I'll take it, Christopher. Like when I want to freak people out now, I introduce myself as Chris because that's what my mom calls me. And people are like, who's Chris? You know, because people know me as KC, but anything works, Robert, you know.
You should go through all the phases, I say. But yeah, thank you for, well, first introducing me to the world of personal development. I think I was someone who was much more willing to just follow someone else's drum and rhythm.
Yeah.
And you were one of the first person I encountered that pushed me to go outside the box. I didn't even have a piano that's sitting right next to me when we first started. I can't imagine that I'm here now, really. I couldn't have possibly, but I think it has to do with all of the people along the way, including you. So thank you.
Yeah, well, my absolute pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure to admire all your work from afar. I can't tell you how many times I was, my coach, Christine Sachs, was your lead trainer in the training program for accomplishment coaching. I can't tell you how many times her and I just stood back in awe and wonder, just grateful to know you and watch you soar. So I'm really proud of you, man. You should be very, very proud of yourself and the life you've created.
Thank you. Thank you. Same to you and also to Christine as well. But power to helping each other out, really.
Absolutely. It's the least we can do.